Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
Well, it's time on our Author of the Week feature to actually have another one of our legendary panels in many ways. And we're delighted to actually welcome three fabulous individuals to share their thoughts in terms of the whole wonderful world of publishing and creativity and so on. First up, actually, because she was first into the actual Zoom room, we're going to welcome college librarian and indeed a professor who speaks and writes about music, blending in elements of memoir, travel, art and literature. She has actually just produced the awesomely wonderful Nerds Traveler. It's Margaret Montet. How are you, Margaret?
Hi, I'm great. Glad to be here.
Well, great to connect with your good self, and delighted to welcome you to your first official feature. And we've also got sharing with us the whole notion of a collection of stories that is truly unique and is a testament to the culture of America, of course, under the title Americana Stories, the fabulous Bill Hebbing. How are you, Bill?
I'm very well, Alex. Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity.
Excellent. It's great to connect with your good self. And we've also got, from the joys of furious publishing, for readers who read furiously, of course, the one and only Adam Wilson. How are you, Adam?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Excellent. We've also got our regular correspondent from, of course, Bucharest and Romania, Anna Coscanel, who'll be sharing some thoughts with us as well. I think Jessica Bertus will be joining us from North Carolina too. Adam, if I can come to you first, tell us a little bit about Furious Publishing, because obviously, as you say, set up in 2014 originally, and for readers who like to read furiously.
Yes, exactly. So yes, as you said, Read Furiously is a publishing company that my partner, Samantha, and I started back in 2014. And it really just came about by means of wanting to try to do something more. We were both writers. We had both been working in the industry for a while. I'd, you know, published a few books with independent presses. She had been working as a journalist for a few online correspondences. And, you know, just looking at the state of the industry and looking at the people that we had met over the years and the people that we were seeing trying to break into publishing, we just really felt that, you know, there had to be a different way to do this. You know, there had to be a way that we could support people who might not necessarily have an easy time pitching their books to publishers, getting their work out there. And so we really wanted to kind of figure out what that could be. And we took it upon ourselves to kind of try and figure out, like, you know, as authors, what would we want going into a publishing company? And what would we want to see being put out by a publishing company? So we really kind of, we took the time, we kind of said, okay, well, here are the criteria, the things that we would want to do. And, you know, here are the things that are important to us as readers. And, you know, we wanted to make sure that there was a level of activism in our work, that we were using this publishing platform to not only enhance voices of people who might not necessarily get a chance to be published elsewhere, but also really take what we make as a publisher and find ways to give back to the community as well. So, you know, we kind of try and brand ourselves as an advocate press as much as we possible. So, and an activist press. So, you know, we take profits from our sales. We, you know, donate to them to various literary charities like Room to Read, Reading is Fundamental. Those are kind of some of the larger ones, but also more local ones like Task, which is a local one here in New Jersey that works with the unhoused trans community. So, and then also just the Little Free Library Network throughout the United States, where, you know, they have the little boxes that are set up throughout the country, and you can, you know, go drop off books. We've supported a few of those. We do annual Angel Days, where we go out and we just try and visit as many Little Free Libraries as possible, dropping off books into those. And so we really try and lead with our values in that sense, not only in the works that we choose to publish, but also in the causes that we choose to support.
Which is really part of the whole essence. Now let's turn to Margaret, because Margaret, you're obviously with Read Furiously. They're based, of course, in central New Jersey. You're in New Jersey at present, so exciting from that point of view. And I've got to say, I had a lovely smile when I was reading the descriptor of yourself as a nerd traveler, setting off across the United States and around the globe on a journey of intellectual curiosity, combining history, biography, and the culture of each city. Let's talk a little bit about Nerd Traveler before the rationale for why you feel, well, this could only be published by Read Furiously.
Oh, well, Let's see. So I talk to a lot of agents and I talk to a lot of publishers, and nobody really got this until I was just chatting with Samantha. I had an essay in one of their anthologies, and we just got to talking, and I said, "Well, you know, I have this collection of essays about traveling, just like this one that we're putting in the anthology." And she said, "Oh, I would like to look at that." And she got it right away. She understood what I was getting at. The idea, you know, as Joan Didion said, we tell ourselves stories in order to live. It's looking at the different, just traveling by yourself, traveling with somebody else, traveling with a group. I've done all of that, and going to other places and meeting different people. It's just the human experience. So Samantha understood all that, and so it was a match made in heaven.
And that again is such a wonderful sort of way of actually getting that fit between the publisher, the creator, the development within that whole field. Talk about obviously the need for traveling. Let's talk about again another Read Furiously classic and newer, the thing we've already mentioned so far, Americana Stories. Bill, share with us your own journey to Americana, a collection of snapshots that capture everyday American encounters. I'll be coming to find out from Jessica shortly whether she feels as though North Carolina needs to be represented here. I'm sure she will. But share with us, Bill, your lines on this particular thing.
North
Inspired
Carolina is
us.
not specifically represented in my stories, but I'm happy to include it at some point. I started in much the same way with Read Furiously as Margaret did. When they started producing the Life in the Garden State series, which has two editions out so far, and I have a story in each of them. And I lived in New Jersey until several years ago, and now I'm just across the river in Pennsylvania. I can see New Jersey from my driveway. A lot of my stories had been set in New Jersey, so I started submitting them, and they started publishing them. And then eventually, I contacted Samantha, and I said, "You know, I have body of stories, and I think I have a collection here. Would you be interested in looking at it?" And she said, "Yes, we want it," almost immediately. So that's sort of my short
Yeah.
form success story.
Again, I just like the notion of welcome to Bill Hennig's Americana, a collection of snapshots that capture everyday American encounters from filling the bird feeder to a Rialto conference, the happiest place on earth to the picturesque canals of Venice, actually. Each story celebrates the eccentricities hidden inside the fabric of an ordinary life. And is that something, Adam, which when you're looking for this whole system, that if you were asked to effectively define what Read Furiously really is at its core, what its core values are, is it the kind of work that both Bill and Margaret have shared with us and indeed have produced for you? Is that the format you'd like to go for?
I guess, I mean, if we had to sum it up, I think the best way to do that in like a succinct way would be to kind of focus on the stories that no one else could tell, but everyone else would want to hear. I mean, if you look at a book like Nerd Traveler, if you look at Americana, if you look at any of the things that we publish, they're really these stories that have such a distinctive voice for each of their authors, but they're stories that when you actually dive into them, when you read them, you can completely connect to them on some level, you know. You don't have to have traveled the world and be interested in, you know, classical music and history the same way Margaret is to really understand, you know, the way that she's approaching these stories. There's a wonderful element of memoir to them. And the same way with Americana and Bill, you know, it's like the stories are so, they're so only, they're stories that only Bill could write. But as you read them, you appreciate them on such a personal level. You really connect with all the things that he's trying to talk about. You know, of just these little snapshots of America, the idea of loss, the idea of love, the idea of interaction between people nowadays, and what does that mean? And it really is just that idea of, like, you know, the stories that we want to tell are the stories that people want to hear but might not realize it, but also the stories that the authors just really, really have to share with each other.
We're 10 years into the launch of Read Furiously. Again, astoundingly, it's 2014. when Samantha Azeti and yourself, of course, put the whole thing together. Do you feel as though your objective of creating a generation of readers who view reading as a necessity for this busy world, is it there? Is it being achieved? Are people loving to read, or is it a case of, well, we've got ChatGPT to read for us now, why would we bother to read?
It's always going to be an uphill battle. Reading is always going to be one of those things that people will do, but they won't necessarily prioritize. And we definitely have wins, and we definitely have seen instances where there is indifference. But I mean, a perfect example of that is we have a series that we publish called the One and Done series, and Margaret and Bill are actually both, and myself, we're all contributors to it. And that actually came from this idea that when we first started as a publishing company, we did a lot of live events. We did artist fairs. We did punk rock flea markets. We did all these different sorts of events where we'd go out and talk to people and say, like, okay, well, what are you interested in reading? What do you enjoy? And one of the biggest things that we always heard from people was like, oh, I'd love to read, but I don't have the time, or I don't want to take a chance on a book that might, I might have to dedicate 1,500 pages, and I don't really like it that much. And so we came up with this idea of what we call the One and Done series, and it's these short, succinct books. They're pocket-sized, about the size of a cell phone, so they can very easily travel with you wherever you go. They're self-contained, so each one is just its own individual story. You don't have to worry about getting bogged down in continuity of what happened in the last three books. And they're really just, we pick some really talented writers to work with, and they produce some really amazing work, and they really can be read in some cases in a single weekend, in a single day. And it offers that kind of self sense of accomplishment of like, hey, I did this. I read this entire book. And that has been probably one of the biggest wins that we've had, because we still do in-person events now that that's becoming more of a thing again in this post-pandemic world. And that is probably one of the most popular things that we have. We have people who come up to us and look at it and be like, we'll pitch someone what the series is. We'll explain it. We'll explain some of what some of the books are. And we published 7 volumes so far. We've had people who come and will just buy the entire 7-volume series without even picking up one of them. And then, we'll come back to them a few days, later, and they'll be like, that was a great idea. I have to commute to and from the city every day, and I've just every single week I have a different one of those books with me, and it's wonderful, and I'm not on my phone as much. So, yeah, I mean, there are wins. It's always going to be an uphill battle, but those are the kinds of things that we really, really value as a publisher, is getting to do that kind of stuff.
Okay, let's open it up a little bit and let's turn to two of our own furious readers. Although I had never used that adjective before in describing Jessica or indeed Anna. Jessica, we'll come to you first and stay over in North America at least from your North Carolina base. Any general questions you'd like to raise with either Margaret, Bill, or Adam, or any observations that you've heard so far about, obviously, the way in and the focus of the books that they're producing?
Yeah, no, I mean, it sounds so interesting. And I would just like to ask that question about the genesis of how you all got interested in publishing and your literary genres. What initially sparked that love of reading for you that this publishing is trying to inspire?
Bill, would you like to go first?
Sure. I mean, I've always loved to read. I'm a lifelong introvert, and I like going into other worlds by myself. And I've always written. I've been writing since as long as I can remember that I've been able to pick up a pencil. I was involved with the theater for a number of years and had a few plays produced, and then that kind of fizzled out, and I lost my connections, and I decided to turn my attention to fiction, and it's gone really well so far, but it's been a long journey. I've only been published for maybe 10 years now, but yeah, I mean, my life just isn't a straight line, but I'm here, and I'm in a place that I like right now, and I discover a lot about myself through writing fiction.
I'm not sure whether anybody's life is a straight line, but Margaret, perhaps you'd say mine is absolutely pinpoint straight, absolutely all along the way.
Well, in some respects, yeah, my life is a straight line, but in the writing respect, I've always, just like Bill, I've been a writer and a reader all my life, and it was always a joyful thing going to the library with my mom or both parents and picking out books and all that. So it's always been something I loved. And once I got into my librarian career, I began writing just as a creative outlet, you know, because when you're a young librarian, you don't have that many creative projects to do. So I would, on my own time, I'd be writing, and I started writing about locations, kind of in the sense of a travel article, where to go, what to visit. And I've lived part-time for my entire life in Cape May, New Jersey, which is a beach town with lots of history and lots of wonderful nature, birding and all that. And so I started writing about Cape May because I knew it so well, and got these published and just kept going, writing about other places. And then at some point I said, you know, I'm getting tired of writing these. I want to get into more literary writing. And that's when I went in my 50s and got an MFA degree. And my program actually traveled each summer to a different European city. So some of the essays are about those cities and traveling with a cohort of about 25 people, who most of them were young 20-something women, and how that's where I got the nerd traveler from, because they were interested in going around and meeting people and having drinks and eating. And I wanted to learn about that museum and that cathedral. And I would read about them and I'd go inside and take tours of them. So that's where the nerd traveler came from. And also trying to learn the language, not being very successful with it, but at least I could order food or ask where the hotel might be. And, you know, so yeah, that's where the nerd traveler came from. So it kind of sounds like a straight line, but in actuality, it wasn't. But that's pretty much my story.
I'm going to come to Adam in a few moments, but I think it's worthwhile bringing in Anna at this particular point because Anna, obviously, you might be able to identify with some of Margaret's lines there, albeit from the Romanian perspective of obviously being a Romanian postgraduate student in the UK. Any questions for yourself, or indeed, do you identify with being a nerd traveller as well?
I was actually thinking that I feel like it's a very deep discussion today, because not only I can somehow relate to it, but it brings me so much pleasure to hear that, not to hear the word nerd not being used in a bad way, but as something good, because I feel like we are all a bit nerds at times. And I think, I don't know, to me reading is just the biggest pleasure in life, because you can create, no matter what you read, you can create your own universe, and you can create anything by writing and by reading, because you know you have your imagination. And also, I don't know, my earliest memories in life are my grandpa reading to me stories and everything. But I do have questions, obviously. I have lots of questions, but to you, all of you, actually, my questions are, out of every person you have encountered or place that you wrote about, and obviously when you're writing, you're basically exposing your souls and hearts, do you feel like there is a specific person or place that you left a part of your soul with? Because I know there are moments in life and places that I've visited and moments that I've lived in which I left a part of me and I wrote about them. And every time I go back and read that, I can feel that part of me there, that I don't have it anymore, but it's in there. So I'm just thinking, do you feel like you have something, a place or a person that you wrote and it was so deep to you that makes you feel that way?
An interesting line. Let's go back to Margaret on that one. It's bounced straight back to yourself, etc. Parts of your soul being left in print for posterity and immortality.
Yes, I did an essay on Concord, Massachusetts, and I planned a little research trip to go up there. That's where the Transcendentalists were, Henry David Thoreau and Ralph Waldo Emerson and Alcott and all of those. Anyway, I was planning a trip up there, and I was mentioning it to my sister, and I said, oh, I'm going to go to Louisa May Alcott's house too, because her father was a transcendentalist. But I really wanted to see, you know, from Little Women, which was both of our favorite book growing up. And she said, oh, and I could just tell by the noises she was making on the phone. And I said, well, would you like to go with me? And she said, yes. She didn't even hesitate. So we drove up and we stayed in a kind of goofy hotel. It wasn't a fancy colonial one or anything. And we visited the places and we saved Louisa May Alcott's home for last. And we just loved the tour. You know, it was so interesting. We had a very animated tour guide. And as we were leaving, I might burst out into tears. My sister said, well, that's a dream fulfilled. With all the traveling she had done, she had never been to the Alcott's home. And I was the one that made it possible. And soon after that trip, within a year, she had passed away. And so when I think about that trip and going to Louisa May Alcott's house, I just get all misty and think, gosh, that was just the best thing at the perfect time. And I have a picture of her standing in front of the house, and it means so much to me. However, the picture of me standing in front of the house is still in her camera, and I don't know whatever happened to that. So I'm going to have to go back in the springtime when the lilacs are in bloom to redo that photo. But for now, that's the place that I left part of my heart.
And Bill, what about Americana, or indeed other texts that you've worked through? Any sort of parts that you've said, yes, that's connected?
Yeah, I have a couple of examples. The very first story in the collection takes place in a hotel room in Anaheim, California, that has a view of Disneyland. And I had been in such a hotel room at one point. I'm a librarian like Margaret, and I belong to a couple of different organizations. And for some reason, I kept getting fated to attend conferences in Anaheim. I believe I've been there four times. And if you're not familiar, it's a great place to take children once. But outside of that, it's kind of a cultural wasteland, in my opinion. There's not a lot of good food. It's all very family oriented. I'm not
it's
a
not New Jersey. Family. Let's face it.
not all of New Jersey, but some. So I had a strong connection to that hotel room. So I set my my story. It involves a female real estate agent who's there attending a conference, and then she has a sort of a virtual altercation with her husband. But just having been in that room, it gave me a lot of ideas for how to work Disneyland and commercialism into the fabric of the story. My other example is I have one that takes, you mentioned it, I have one that takes place at an outdoor cafe in Venice. And I'd been to Italy before, but my first trip to Venice, I wasn't really expecting to like it very much because I'm an outdoorsy sort of person and pretty much all the plants in Venice are behind people's walls and you can't see them. But I totally fell in love with the place. And my partner and I had lunch at the exact cafe that I write about in the story, and the situation is completely different. What happens did not happen, but I still feel a real tie to Venice.
And dialing back to Jessica's original question for Adam, I mean, I don't know if you've remembered it from that point of view. What about your own kind of pathway and thoughts on this one, Adam?
So I came kind of roundabout in circles, and then eventually a straight line. Growing up, I was always writing. I just never really had the right outlet for it. I was always trying different things and never really liking what I was producing. Eventually, though, when I went to college, I started getting really into independent comics, guys like Craig Thompson, Harvey Pekar. And, you know, as a kid, I was a huge superhero fan. I was obsessed with Superman, Batman, things like that. But you age
so
out
DC
of that.
DC as opposed to Marvel, then, obviously.
Yes, yes. But, you know, I aged out of that, you know, by the time I was 14, 15, I was more interested in music. I was, you know, things like that. But, when I started to read these new people that I was discovering. I was like, I never knew comics could do that. This is amazing. I always just kind of wrote it off as, you know, the superhero thing with the floppies. I didn't really think that, you know, like a graphic novel about, you know, exploring someone's life in Cleveland or something like that. And so I really just got really interested in that. And I really said, you know what, let me try this. I've never really had a writing medium that worked for me, but you know, let me see if this works. And I kind of took to it like a duck takes to water. It just like something about the sequential breakdown of a page, how it's equal parts, you know, graphic design and storytelling. It just, I loved it and I really enjoyed it. And so I started self-publishing comics with a friend of mine in college. We would break into the school computer lab and print out page after page after page and staple them together, sell them to friends on campus. And I kind of parlayed that into a career in comics, where I was, you know, I got my first graphic novel published, which was equal parts a superhero story and a coming of age friendship story. And that was actually how, probably when for me the onus of Read Furiously took place, because this book was too, you know, mundane for the superhero crowd, but too outlandish for the people who just wanted to read, you know, everyday slice of life stories. And I was like, okay, well, I don't really have a place on either side of the fence, so let me just see if I can find my own place. And Samantha was kind of going through something similar on her end, where the stories that she was looking to tell were the stories that she was pitching to the different magazines. They weren't really being picked up, that they weren't really interested in them. And so she said, you know what, let's just make our own place and let's start telling the stories that we want to tell. And that was kind of the thing that kicked off that conversation for both of us, and kind of really inspired going forward that idea of like the stories that the authors want to tell that we know are going to connect with the readers who want to hear them.
That's really one of the strengths, I suppose, of not necessarily the self-publishing route, but actually doing it for oneself and actually ensuring that you're happy with the whole story. Let's turn back to Jessica, if we may, because Jessica, appreciate you've got a master's degree in children's literature from Trinity College Dublin. Obviously, you spent time over in Lincoln. You were connected on that sort of basis. Could arguably sort of have some of those initial nerd traveler aspects as well, to your credit. But any other questions or thoughts you'd like to raise with the team?
I would have to say, if you have to name one author that you think has really had an impact on your writing, who would that have to be? It can be anyone in any time period.
Let's take Adam first. I mean, I'd be tempted to go for Neil Adams and probably Denny O'Neill, but you know, I might be way off base there.
Actually, I'm going to pick two people, but they're twins, so I think that counts as one. But Fabio Moon and Gabriel Ba, they're Brazilian comic artists, and their work is amazing, just in the sense of they're able to kind of move within different genres, and they're able to capture like the very mundane, but also the very fantastical and magical as well. And I think that, you know, as I was starting to get back into comics, that was one of the things that I really appreciated, was being able, was, you know, writers and artists who are able to really kind of straddle that line between doing something very ordinary and very fantastical as well. And I think looking back at the writing that I've done since getting back into comics, I think that they probably had the biggest influence of kind of like the story that I try and tell over time.
Margaret.
It's a tough decision, but I'm going to go with Paul Theroux, who writes fiction, but he's known for his nonfiction, and especially tales of really long train rides. And he talks to people on the train, and he points out, you know, you can talk to them and then you can quote them later in your book or your essay, and they're not going to know that you did it. So I thought that was the funniest thing, because you see so many things on a train. And I was reading one of his books on the train to Pittsburgh to visit my friend, and a whole bunch of drama erupted on this train, and very kooky characters walking around. And I thought, this is perfect, because I could see the stuff going around me. The woman in front of me dropped her hearing aid, and she thought it was under her chair, and she asked if I could help. So I got down on the floor and I looked all over the place for that hearing aid, and it wasn't there. So I asked what is, he's not the, is he the conductor?
He would be on
I
the
forget.
train. Yeah.
The guy in the train with the uniform, and he was able to move the seat, and the hearing aid had gone underneath her armrest, and she was so so happy that I thought to ask him and that I had gotten down on my hands and knees to look for the thing. And, you know, it just reminded me of this book I was reading where he's talking about how you only see what's inside the train and what's next to the train tracks. You're not really seeing the different cities, maybe the countryside, but it was just the funniest thing. But Paul Theroux, I just love his style. I might just quickly say, and also John McPhee and Joan Didion, I love them too.
Just for a moment, I thought we were having a moment there with respect to a slice of cake dissolving slowly and leading to remembrance of things past. But that's another tale for another experience. Bill, what about yourself? Favorite authors?
If I had to name an author, I would say probably Virginia Woolf first, although I don't really write much like her. Thomas Mann, I admire quite a bit because he's able to give a mythic dimension to ordinary happenings. But my real answer would be Beethoven. I'm much more influenced by music than I am by other authors. And Beethoven's just at the top of my computer list. Just his way he can introduce themes, develop them, repeat them, invert them, and find rhythms and you know, eventually explore these themes and repeat them until you come to a conclusion. That's had much more of an influence on my work than any author has.
They're both forms of storytelling.
Absolutely.
The fascinating sort of interconnection between music and the written word as well from that point of view. Amazingly, we're actually beginning to come to the close of this fascinating insight into a whole range of things. I want to actually plug furiously, read furiously. So I did that. Because obviously you can connect on the basis of read furiously. Would you like to just share with us initially how people can actually access on an international basis the read furiously routine? Adam.
Yes. Yeah. So our books are available wherever books are sold. You can go to your local bookstore and ask for them. They might not always have them in stock, but they can definitely get them wherever. Anyone who has an Ingram account, any bookstore that has that, which usually is most. But so our books are available wherever books are sold. You can order them directly from us. Shipping might be a little high going international, but you can check out our website readfuriously.com. We try whenever possible to have an international link on each of our book's landing pages too, so we make it easy for you if you do want to order it overseas.
And margaretmontet.com, a good place as well as Read Furiously to connect with yourself, Margaret?
Absolutely, yes. I have a newsletter and people can sign up for that to find out what's coming next.
Okay. And Bill, any ways in which people can follow through the Americana scenario?
Yes, I do have a webpage. If anybody Googles the Arts and Cultural Council of Bucks County and looks at member profiles, and just scroll down until you find Bill Hemigan, you get information about all my work.
And just a sort of final general question, because I mean, obviously with Anna and Jessica, I feel we're in good hands for the next generation of readers from that point of view. Adam, do you feel as though actually, again, in terms of the mission of Read Furiously, that actually, as we head into the second quarter of the 21st century, that reading will continue to have its essential connection with the human spirit?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the way that people will read is always going to evolve and change. But I definitely think that no matter what, it will be an essential part of it. You know, whether it's ebooks, audiobooks, whether it's, you know, traditional print, you know, that's always going to be there. But, you know, even if it's something serialized on a, there are comics, for example, that have their own website. And I've been reading some of them for going on 10, 15 years now, but every single day, like, you know, reading the newspaper, I go and I check them. So I think, you know, reading is always going to be a fundamental part of, you know, people's lives. And really, it's just a matter of where they find it.
Essential. We will be having some music by Beethoven before the next sort of piece comes through. Bill, have you had a reasonably satisfying first debut on this panel format for the Madrid Drive Author of the Week? Has it been good for you, Bill?
This has been very enjoyable. Thank you very much. This has been great. Lots
Margaret, you were first in the room. Has it been worthwhile? Have you enjoyed the last 30-odd minutes?
Oh, yes, very much. I know Bill pretty well, so it's always fun to hear how he answers questions. And Adam, too, I'm getting to know him kind of well. So that's fun, and just kind of sharing my own thoughts.
And
it's
Adam,
a thrill.
Adam, from the graphic narrative point of view, were you also quite happy with respect to how we're furiously dealing with Read Furiously?
Absolutely, yes. No, it's been great. So thank you very much.
So, well, thanks obviously to Jessica and to Anna. I know Jessica's devastated we haven't had a chance to ask her traditional North Carolina. I think we can quickly do it. Jessica, would you like to just quickly ask our three contributors here the nutrition question, please?
Yes, we would love to know if you've ever tried some snacks from around the Carolinas and just broadly the South, but have you ever had sweet tea or boiled peanuts by chance?
Margaret.
I've had sweet tea, but I stay away from peanuts because I'm allergic to them. So I know of them, but I have not eaten.
That is a very good reason.
Bill.
I have had neither of those things, but I have had fried pickles in Nashville.
You know, that's a good third one.
That could be a third edition, Jessica, for future editions. And Adam, is it a case of, goodness sake, this is New Jersey. What do you expect us to actually do?
Sweet tea, definitely. Boiled peanuts I've had once at a state fair, and I'm good. That's enough.
At least you tried it.
Yes.
That's the important thing. To Adam Wilson, Bill Hennig, and Margaret Montet, huge thanks indeed. Again, keep on reading, keep on writing, folks, because your creators are essential to the whole process. And thanks, obviously, to Anna and Jessica as well. And we'll speak again very soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
£728. Yes, a significant sum of money in many ways. Apparently, the amount of food that we throw away on an annual basis, with each household pretty much getting rid of fresh fruits and vegetables that effectively have passed their sell-by date, etc. So what's the solution? Could it possibly be canned food? Could we actually be going back to the whole notion of canned food? Well, somebody who's got a lot of things to say with respect to this return back to the future, maybe, is TV chef extraordinaire. That's Dean Edwards. How are you, Dean?
I'm very good. And yourself?
Yeah, fine, but surprised in a sense by this, because there was a moment, I think, a few years ago where people were thinking, well, it's either frozen food or it's fresh food. We don't deal with canned food now. It's all gone. But actually, canned food's still very much important in our weekly shop.
It really is. And, you know, I've been a massive fan of using canned food actually long before I got into cooking professionally. So I don't know whether you know too much about my backstory, but I was actually a digger driver up until 2006 when I entered into MasterChef. So before that, I actually cooked just because I have a huge love of food and cooking, and due to, you know, various different reasons, but and also the way I was taught to cook some of these recipes by my parents and grandparents, I always used a lot of canned food within my cooking. So, you know, I'm glad to see that the research has kind of come back around full circle. And actually, canned food, Love Canned Food commissioned expert nutritionists at Manchester Metropolitan University to compare 15 recipes that were made either with canned food or fresh ingredients. And what they actually found might surprise you, because we know the benefits of canned food. They can often be a lot cheaper than their fresh counterparts. And obviously, one of the huge benefits is the much longer shelf life, in some occasions up to 5 years. But what was really cool to see, this research actually showed that in terms of taste, now this is where people don't seem to realize, you know, in terms of taste, canned food can stand up to its counterparts. With 13 of the 15 recipes that were tested actually showed, in terms of the taste test, the blind taste test, there was no significant preference for the fresh over the canned, which I think is really, really cool, because I think there's a stigma attached to cooking with canned ingredients, and people associate them, you know, they're not going to be as healthy, they're not going to taste as good. So this has been fantastic, because I think canned food alongside, you know, fresh and frozen ingredients can be an amazing kind of addition to your stock cupboards, you know, especially in times when you're kind of in a little bit of a bind and you need to throw something together. You know, you can always reach into the cupboard and find something you can make a really tasty meal from.
I mean, this is, of course, the important point, because I seem to recall that certainly canned soup was one of the ways forward for students, of course, canned beans, of course, very much in place there. But that fact, as you said, that the canned food can last up to 5 years. Also, perhaps more importantly, it keeps its nutritional value. That's also significant, I would have thought.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the main reasons I opted towards canned food when I was a student was the cost factor. You know, it was, I used to save a lot of money by using canned ingredients in my cooking, and quite often using ingredients like potatoes, chickpeas, to really bulk out meals, you know. So I was using them alongside fresh ingredients. So you're getting that balanced kind of nutrition, and you're getting a balanced meal. And I think a lot of people tend to think that once something's canned, it loses that nutrition, but that's not the case. Obviously, anytime an ingredient is processed, you lose some of the nutrition, but in essence, that goes for cooking the ingredients. If you buy fresh ingredients, you cook them, you lose some of that nutrition. So I'm quite concerned with the way that people cook their ingredients as well. I think that's key. It's not just all about whether fresh, frozen, or canned. It's the way that these ingredients are treated along the way. And I truly believe you can cook up some really tasty, nutritious meals using canned food, you know, alongside frozen and fresh as well, you know, because I think that's the way that we cook, don't we?
Well, certainly looking at just some of the costings, I mean, tomato soup, if you actually bought it fresh, £2, 50 pence for canned soup. So a significant saving on that basis. Meatballs, £2.19 compared with a canned pack of 90 pence. Stewing steak, £5 if you bought it fresh, £1.90 if you're going for a canned version. I mean, it kind of makes sense in a cost of living crisis to really think very seriously about the choices of food that we're actually having, but perhaps also the way in which we're purchasing it.
Absolutely. And, you know, one that you missed off the list was probably the one that I think people tend to reach for before their fresh counterpart is tuna. Now, wow. I'm pretty sure that most households up and down the country probably got a tin of tuna knocking around in the cupboard. Now, a tin of tuna costs around £1.75 at the moment. There are offers to be had as well. I always, you know, I shop in the supermarkets and I quite often see packs of tuna and, you know, you get a better price per can. As opposed to £8 for a packet of fresh tuna at the moment. So, you know, the savings you can make can be really considerable. But you just talked about the cost of living crisis, and that's something that, you know, really touches base with me. And, you know, we've always had to watch money, you know, in our household from growing up and even now, you know. And it's, I think it's, my friends call me tight, but I like it. I like to be known I'm thrifty. you know, but I like to look after money. But I think this is the first time in my particular lifetime where households have had to be concerned with not only the cost of the ingredients, but also the way that we cook the ingredients as well. Hence why we're seeing huge rises in people opting for smart appliances like microwaves, air fryers, slow cookers, which are all very energy efficient ways of cooking. You know, so by having a balance of using canned, fresh, and maybe considering different ways to cook these ingredients, you can save a lot of money. But the key thing is planning of meals. And I think this is hugely key, because each family in the UK on average wastes over £700 a year in food waste. And a lot of that comes from fresh fruits and vegetables. Now, we're all guilty of it, and I'm pretty sure if I looked in the back of my fridge now in the vegetable drawer, there might be a couple of old parsnips or a couple of carrots that are probably way past their best. You know, I do my best to try and save them, but we do waste a lot of foods. But so by having canned ingredients in our store cupboards alongside the fresh, we can minimize the amount of food that we waste. Because if life doesn't go to plan, which quite often it doesn't, and, you know, you don't get time to cook that meal that you planned for this evening's meal, you know, the canned ingredients will still be fresh, you know, for the next 5 years. So I'm pretty sure, you know, at some point you'll get around to using them. And I think it's key, and it's just about changing the mindsets when it comes to cooking, that using canned ingredients in food doesn't necessarily mean you have to compromise on taste. And I think that's key. And in actual fact, I think there are some ingredients which are canned, which I believe are better to cook with in terms of taste than their fresh counterparts.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the reasons why not only have you produced the best-selling Cook Slow, but also Feel Good Family Food and Mintspiration, Dean. You are an inspiration in all sorts of ways. Dean, if people want to actually find out further details about this particular survey and investigation, where would you point them?
Yeah, and not only that, if people want recipe inspiration as well, you know, to cook some of these recipes that, you know, I'm kind of banging on about a little bit, if they go to on the web, if you go to lovecannedfood.com, lots and lots of recipes, inspiration on there, and also lots of findings about the study and canned ingredients. But also, if you're a bit more social media savvy, then on Instagram at lovecannedfood, lots of recipes again, including lots of video recipes. So even if you're not the most confident of cooks and you want to kind of be almost ran through it a little bit, because I know it can be a bit daunting looking at a recipe and go, oh, you know, that seems quite complicated. When you see the recipe video, sometimes it can be as simple as chucking a load of ingredients, say, into your slow cooker and just letting the slow cooker work its magic. So loads and loads of inspiration there. And thank you so, so much for all your time.
Well, Dean, it's been awesome connecting with you, good self. Again, an absolute delight. TV chef extraordinaire, Dean Edwards. Keep on keeping on. And yes, I think we should actually say Dean Thrifty Edwards, basically. We'll have that in terms of the bracket. And hopefully we'll speak again soon.
Thank you, Alex.